I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we want to take a look at this past weekend's G8 summit. We'll talk about what Europe's economic challenges could mean for the U.S. We'll have that conversation in a few minutes. But first, we want to turn our attention to social media. Facebook has been in the news, of course, because of last week's stock offering. But apart from that, Facebook has become a big part of people's everyday lives. It boasts 900 million users. If it were a nation, it would be the third most populous in the world. And after just 5 years in business, Twitter has approximately 175 million users. But just because more people are using social media, it doesn't mean they understand its power. Many users are still learning the hard way how harmful it can be when millions of people can read and judge those status updates and 140-character messages. We thought since summer is around the corner and people might be tempted to post pics of their latest beer bashes, that this might be a good time to talk about the potential pitfalls of social media. We've called LaToya Peterson. She is the editor of the blog Racialicious. Also with us, Eric Scheninger. He is the principal of New Milford High School in New Jersey. He's known as the Twitter principal because he is active on almost every social media network. He also takes a hands-on approach to educating his students about the advantages and downsides of social media. He's at school, so if you hear some school noises in the background, you'll know what that is. Welcome to you both. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
LaToya, let me start with you. Twitter, of course, is a way for figures, public figures, to develop a following. But it just seems like every week we're reading about somebody stubbing his or her toe on this. I mean, of course, Spike Lee had to apologize for tweeting an incorrect address for George Zimmerman, who, of course, is the shooter in the Trayvon Martin case. And who could forget Anthony Weiner, a member of Congress, having to resign because of a careless Twitter picture of something he should not have tweeted a picture about. So I'm just wondering, what is it, do you think, about Twitter that makes people forget that the world is reading it?
Well, you know, my friend Dana Boyd, who is a researcher and she does a lot of work with research in teens, has a great idea on this, which is that, you know, Twitter and social media in general is kind of blurring the boundary between like this private intimate space and public space, right? And so for most people who are not in the public eye, we have this idea that we are anonymous in our daily lives. Like, who really cares about your status updates except for the people who know you and the people who love you? For celebrities, that becomes even more warped because they know they're talking to their fans and yet they're creating this intimate space with their fans. So you have people like Kim Kardashian tweeting, you know, what should I wear today? You know, how should I style my hair? And it becomes this very affirming relationship. And at the same time, it makes people feel very safe. And so they start to drop their guard and say things that they really shouldn't.
In a way, you hear that people say they forget that the cameras are there.
Exactly.
That kind of thing. Although I don't know how you could forget that these giant microphones are in your faces just so that, you know, we are on the air, folks. We are actually talking to people, millions of people. So, you know, Eric, we know that Twitter and Facebook can actually make grown people act like teenagers, like LaToya was just saying. You actually work with teenagers as the principal at New Milford High. When did you get the idea that it was important to start incorporating social media into the educational experience?
Well, I think it began with when I sort of stuck my toe into the water and quickly realized that, you know, social media could be a valuable tool for teaching and learning. You know, I was the principal that blocked, banned, prohibited, and felt that social media had absolutely no place in education. But once I began to use it and I saw the many merits associated with these forms of technology, as I became more knowledgeable and also started to hear and see all of the negative stories involving social media, and whether it be student behavior or staff behavior, I decided that, you know what, I'm in the business of education. I need to work with my students and teach them how to be digitally responsible. I think across the country, schools, you know, fail to educate students on appropriate use of social media. Primarily, they feel that, you know, it has no place in school, so why bother? But you know what? It's not going away. And what we've started to do is I actually lead these seminars myself. We bring every single student into the auditorium. We talk about cyberbullying. We talk about digital footprints. We talk about the negative impact that tweets or Facebook posts can eventually have in terms of getting into college or getting a job. And we actually then share some concrete examples of situations that we've dealt with here with our students and sort of like put the students on the right path. And the end result has been a dramatic decrease in cyberbullying. Students are actually taking down their Facebook pages. They're reporting now to us, to school officials across the district, acts of cyberbullying that they see, and they understand that, you know what, they need to be digitally responsible in this age because once it's posted out there, it doesn't go away.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the advantages and pitfalls of social media with Principal Eric Scheninger of New Milford High School in New Jersey. He's been called the Twitter principal because he's active on social media and also teaches about this, and also blogger LaToya Peterson. You know, we've talked a lot about the cyberbullying with kids. But LaToya, what about cyberbullying among adults? I mean, we've actually had experiences on this program where people, even in advance of an interview airing with someone, someone's decided that they're not going to like in advance what that person is saying, and then they start attacking this person via social media. And, you know, you say to yourself, you can't control that. I mean, there's nothing you can do about that. And I'm just wondering, particularly because you have a blog that addresses sensitive issues, which race is one, are there some guidelines that you employ to help make it the kind of safe space that people would like to have so they can talk about things that are challenging? Or can you just have to tell people to toughen up?
Well, it's challenging because you don't want to tell people to toughen up because this is harassment, right? Like the same things that happens offline with slam books and gossip circles, it just migrates online and it's able to be the volume is just so much higher when it's online, right? If you make a mistake online, instead of having like the five people in front of you like, ooh, I hated that, now you suddenly have 500 people that might have come from Tumblr or Twitter or whatever, and they're all, it feels like a kind of a wave that's crashing. But what we've tried to do to mitigate it, particularly when talking about subjects like race or gender or structural inequality at large, is really one, to set the tone for the place and say this is what's acceptable and this is what's not. Right, so we have all these policies against personal attacks. We have policies surrounding identity. We have policies about how we talk about issues. And we tell people that do not necessarily abide by those policies to leave because that's a problem. Not everyone is invested in having good conversations online. Some people are invested in having these fights or stirring up this drama, and they're not welcome in our space.
So you kick them out.
We
do. If you see these language that you feel crosses a line,
right. We don't approve the comment. Occasionally, we'll engage with things that are problematic if we feel like, you know, so if there's like trans issues, right, they're not necessarily well known. People might not know when they're making a mistake. And so we try to engage if that person becomes defensive or becomes aggressive.
And what do you say to people who feel that you're censoring them?
Censorship is something that's really misunderstood in our society, right? If the government was censoring you, that's one thing. But I'm on a private website, and you can form your own private website and say whatever you feel to do, but you're not going to do that on the property that I have to maintain and I have to pay for.
Eric, do you feel that the students are leading or following in this? For example, we've seen Twitter fights among celebrities like, Rihanna, for example.
Rihanna and Karrueche Tran, yeah.
Yes, and her ex-boyfriend and her and his new inamorata and have gotten into some Twitter fights. And do you feel that the students look at that and think, I should do that too? Or do you think, how do you think that interplay of celebrity behavior affects the student behavior?
I definitely think it is playing a prominent role in students' online behavior because schools have not been proactive enough to sit their kids down and teach them about, you know, internet etiquette, the difference between right or wrong, and the potential negative impact this could have on their lives down the road. You know, for us, what we've done is, you know, being that we're involved as a school and as educators in virtually every social media space, some things have been brought to our attention. And there was one case early this year where some students started a hashtag called NM Problems. And it was started by alumni, but some current students chimed in. And they said some very derogatory remarks in regards to some present teachers. And you know what? Immediately when it came to our attention, we addressed it. We brought those students in, but most importantly, we brought their parents in, and we let them read their public tweets before we brought the kids in. And that had such an impact on the discussions that we had with these kids, because when the parents saw firsthand what was being put online, they were mortified. And since that one point in time this year when we addressed it, we've had no other issues on Twitter throughout the entire year because, A, the students now know, you know, that it's wrong, and, B, they understand that we're out there not policing but making sure that they're making wise decisions in terms of the content that they are posting.
So good piece of advice. Why don't you leave us, Principal Scheninger, if you would, with one brief piece of advice, as many students, you know, they head off into the summer and oftentimes they're not as closely supervised as they are during the school year. best piece of advice for parents and for students?
My piece of advice is, even though you might think it's innocent, it's not that big of a deal, that it's your private and personal information, once you put it on a social media site, it is there for anyone to not only access, but they can then share that information, they can repurpose it, they can adapt it, whether it's pictures, videos, or your thoughts, it could lead to a potential disaster down the road when you're looking to get into that great college or looking for a job. Once it's archived, it can be accessed. And as we tell our students, that's your digital footprint. Do you want your digital footprint to be positive or negative going forward?
Latoya, final word from you, 30 seconds or so. What's your final best piece of advice?
Definitely realize that you're always on the record. And if you're really interested in privacy and online policing, check out places like EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and they tell you kind of ways in which you can look at how people are monitoring you and how you can reduce your digital footprint.
Latoya Peterson is the editor of the blog Racialicious. She was kind enough to join us at our NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Eric Scheninger is a principal of New Milford High School in New Jersey. He was nice enough to take a short break and find some quiet corner at school to talk with us. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we want to talk about the hottest spring trends. But no, we're not talking fashion. We're talking about food. Washington Post food critic Tom Sietsema gives us a few things to chew on in just a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about an international meeting that could have a big impact on what you and I might be paying for that meal out. Leaders from Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Russia, the United Kingdom, and the U.S. met at Camp David over the weekend for the G8 summit. That's the annual meeting of the leaders of the world's largest economies. The big focus was on how this group of economic powerhouses would handle the European financial crisis. That crisis is deepening as Greece talks about leaving the eurozone, but the crisis and the talks could affect places well outside of Europe. We wanted to talk more about that, so we've called Sudeep Reddy. He is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Great to be here.
So you can imagine that there are a lot of people who've been following the news and thinking, you know, it's a shame what's going on in Greece. It's a shame that people are having so much turmoil and difficulty, but what does it have to do with me here in the U.S.? What's the answer?
Well, the risk that we're facing now is that we could see a financial disaster that rivals the one we saw in the fall of 2008.
You mean in the U.S.?
Around the world. It would be the risk is another global financial crisis that starts from Europe instead of starting from the U.S. and spreads around the world and takes down banks not only in Europe but across the pond, and affects countries and major economies all around the world, brings us down, weakens our trade, and really pulls back on economic activity. And if it becomes worse than it was in 2008, then that means it's likely that we could see at least a slowdown in the U.S., if not an outright recession.
What is at the heart of this phase of the financial crisis? I mean, people will remember that there are a couple of phases to the first one, but a big part of the first one was that there were overvalued, that housing, for example, was way overvalued. And when that became apparent, you know, there was a huge crash. We saw that, you know, construction falling off a cliff, you know, housing starts falling off a cliff. What's at the heart of this crisis now in Europe?
Exactly. Both crises, the one in 2008 and the one we could be facing now, are all about debt. The one before was about housing debt in the U.S. This one is really about government debt. And it goes to the core of what Europe has been trying to do for really the last 60 or 70 years. Since World War II, they've been trying to figure out a way to create a stronger Europe, one Europe that doesn't fight wars like they've been fighting for centuries. And one way to do that was to create a common currency. And so they had the euro and created a currency that now has 17 countries out of the 27 European Union countries participating in this currency. And for the last decade, they've actually done fairly well in building a currency that in some senses is starting to rival the U.S. dollar as something that people see as a really important piece of the U.S. Of the international financial architecture. And so in this case, The Euro has 17 members, and they all, while they share a currency, they have different budgets and different budget policies. And so they can all borrow it at different scales. And you have some really strong ones, like the biggest, Germany, that's really disciplined and takes great care in making sure it doesn't spend too much. And on the other end, you have Greece. And Greece hasn't been able to collect taxes properly, hasn't been able to really manage an economy or manage a budget in the way that it needs to. And as a result, for the last 2 years, it's been going in and out of these phases where it always needs a bailout, but it's at risk of now falling to the point where even a bailout isn't going to help.
Well, you've been hearing the debate over the weekend between growth versus austerity. I mean, anybody who's been sort of following international news, even sort of lightly, you know, you hear people in Greece saying, we can't take anymore, we've had enough. And then you hear people sort of on the other side saying, well, you know, we're not going to keep working like crazy to support your lifestyle, so it's got to be austerity. Did the G8 leaders manage to reconcile those very different points of view at all over the G8 summit weekend?
They didn't really. Saying that you're for growth, which all the G8 leaders want, is like saying you're for world peace. Everybody wants growth. Everybody wants their economies to prosper. And in this case, it's not really clear how you solve a problem like Greece without somehow making sure that their spending matches their rate of borrowing and tax collection, all the things you need to make a government and a country run. And they've come to the point where they can't go out and borrow. Nobody's going to make a loan to Greece other than their neighbors. And so unlike the U.S., where we actually do have the ability to borrow and borrow fairly cheaply, Greece has to cut to be able to pull this off because they're relying on their neighbors like Germany to fund the country right now.
Well, you can see what part of the U.S. Role in this would be if there's another kind of huge downturn in Europe. There's going to be less market for U.S. products and so on. You can kind of see the impact there. But are there other impacts on the U.S. that aren't being it's talked about as much? And is there a U.S. role in solving this problem?
Exactly. The broader economy is the concern here, is that if Europe were to go down, Europe as a whole is about the size of the U.S. economy. And if you have such a large player, about a fifth of the world, go down, then it's going to pull down everyone else. And so the direct economic effects are really important. The big unknown in all of this are the financial effects. Europe has huge banks, and those banks are holding government debt. They're holding Greek debt. They're holding Italian and Spanish debt. And the big fear now is not necessarily just about Greece, but that this problem spreads to the other weaker members of the Eurozone that share this currency. Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, they're all under severe pressure. And if they start falling apart, they will all come to the point where they won't be able to borrow. They would need bailouts as well. And then you start getting into much thornier discussions, not only for the Europeans. They've actually gone through this for the last 2 years, creating their own version of the bailout that we had in 2008. So they've got about $600 billion right now that they could use to bail out their neighbors. But that's not nearly enough to solve their problems. And so they might need international loans through the International Monetary Fund, which is the emergency lender. And the U.S. has a share in that. And so we could, in the coming months, face a debate in the U.S. about whether the IMF is going to have a deeper role in bailing out Europe. And obviously, all of that will carry over into our own politics and our own debate here about whether we've done enough and whether we should be rescuing people around the world when we have our own troubles.
And to that end, this is the last question I was going to ask you. How is the European crisis, if that's the right word to use? Is that the right word to use, by the way? Crisis,
it absolutely is.
Is right. Uh-huh. Okay. So now we know why you're not sleeping. Is the European crisis affecting domestic politics? I mean, we're having our own growth versus austerity, you know, bailout, no bailout, you know, cut versus spend debate here, because it's in part because it's a presidential election year, in part because we really do have deep philosophical differences in this country. But is the European crisis affecting the political argument in the U.S. right now?
Absolutely it is. And our election is obviously going to be about the role of government. And they're having that debate right now. How much, how large a government can they handle in Europe? And as they have this, it's obviously affecting financial markets. It's affecting broader economies. And the crisis in Europe is probably between now and November the most important factor that's going to affect the course of our economy, which means that Europe is going to play a bigger role than anything else in determining who could win the election. And obviously, it's a fairly simple formula. Anything that hurts the U.S. economy is probably going to help Mitt Romney become president. Anything that helps the U.S. economy is probably going to substantially raise the chances that Barack Obama becomes reelected. And so the direct ties carry through to our economy and to our politics as well.
Sudeep Reddy is a reporter with The Wall Street Journal. He was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studio. Sudeep, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Now it's time to open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine. That's something we do just about every week for interesting stories about the way we live now. The Washington Post Spring Dining Guide came out this weekend, but we thought even if you don't live in or visit Washington, D.C., we thought food critic Tom Sietsema is a good person to talk about the dining trends you will probably be seeing at a restaurant near you. So, Tom Sietsema, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
So before we get to the food, I want to talk about the food business. The last time you came onto the program, we talked a lot about the way the economic downturn, the recession, if you will, even though the recession is officially over, but how, you know, difficult economic times are affecting the way people eat out, even in an area like Washington, D.C., which is not as so profoundly affected because there's a lot of government spending and so forth. But what have you observed? We talked last time a lot about doing away with things like the bread basket and the tablecloths and things of that sort. What have you seen in the ensuing year?
That's still going on. You know, I was out for dinner last night, and the restaurant had tablecloths, and I thought, what's different about this restaurant? And it's the fact that every other new restaurant that opens in this market, and in other markets too, I travel quite a bit for the Post, seems to be doing away with these things, these practicalities that we used to have. The bread basket, for instance, which can cost $1 to $3 a table. You know, you add that up during the course of business, it can add up to hundreds of dollars. Same thing for linens. Linens are very expensive. Very oftentimes, there's a monopoly in the market. So, you know, you need the linens. You're not going to invest in your own, washing machine or whatever. And then to go along with this, too, a lot of new restaurants aren't dressing up very much. You know, we're seeing fewer luxury restaurants and more restaurants moving into spaces where they're keeping the distressed walls, keeping the cement floors, bringing in repurposed wood. I can't remember the last time I was in a luxury restaurant.
Well, you know, you can imagine for some people eating out anywhere is a luxury. So for some people, this is kind of this is kind of a useless conversation. But for people who are at the other end of the spectrum, is there any, do you hear kind of a restlessness about this? Do you hear that people at the other end of the spectrum who are kind of bored and looking for the next new thing, how are people meeting that need or that desire?
I think there will always be special places to go to, special luxury places. You look at Noma over in Copenhagen, you know, these highly experimental restaurants. That's another thing that's simultaneously happening right now. A lot of younger chefs are breaking off from established chefs and opening up their own mini bars, so to speak. Now, mini bar, for people who don't live in Washington, is this highly experimental Spanish laboratory from the chef Jose Andres. And he's spun off a lot of other restaurants around the country and other imitators around the country. I still think he happens to do it best. Another part of this, too, another side of this coin is the rise in things like organ meats. You know, we all say we're trying to eat healthy, but one thing I noticed, too, is there's a lot more liver on menus. There's tongue. Nose-to-tail eating is what we call it, or nose-to-tail butchering. And chefs are using these cheaper or lesser parts for dinner. Last week, I was in a neighborhood restaurant in Arlington called the Green Pig Bistro. Young chef who is using the whole animal, and I bit into a taco, and it was unusually crunchy, and it turned out to be pig ear.
Oh, dear. My guest is Tom Sietsema.
He's a food critic.
I'll take your word for it. He's the food critic for the Washington Post. His annual Spring Dining Guide was featured in this week's Post magazine, and we're just tucking in with him on the trends that he's seeing in dining around the country. What are there other trends that you want to tell us about? For example, you know, this is a very international city, Washington, D.C., so we're kind of used to a lot of kind of cuisines rising into prominence. Have you observed that there are certain ethnic cuisines that are getting new prominence around the country?
Well, we're lucky because whenever there's a trouble spot in the world, Washington benefits. You know, in the 70s, we had the the rise of Persian restaurants. In the 80s, we had lots of Salvadoran restaurants, you know, and same with Vietnamese restaurants in the 70s and 80s. What I see now nationally, though, is sort of a rise or an interest in Nordic cuisine. We spent a lot of time in sunnier Mediterranean climes, and now we're looking north, the next hot thing, at Nordic food. And we're seeing a lot of – I see this across
Why
the country,
that, though?
Too.
That's not a trouble
well,
spot.
I think it's sort of unlike taking Washington out of this equation. I think it's everyone can relate to meatballs and a little lingonberry or aquavit in their wine, which is a sort of a punch grog that they like to make. Gravlax. I see more smorgasbords. All these sort of Nordic things are coming at the fore right now. And there's a wonderful restaurant in Minneapolis called The Bachelor Farmer, which was opened not too long ago by the sons of the governor, Dayton, there. And they specialize in this. And just I'm from the Midwest. I'm from Minnesota, so it made me feel very much at home.
Comfort food for
Comfort
you.
Comfort food,
wonderful.
Exactly.
What you mentioned earlier that we're supposed to be, air quotes here, thinking about eating healthier, more healthful food, or at least trying to think about eating more healthful food. Are you seeing more healthful options available on menus? Or how are people addressing that desire for it? I mean, I sometimes see people saying things like, ask us what's in this, or we can modify this to your taste or your dietary needs. But is there any general trend toward the kinds of food choices that, for example, the First Lady is trying to encourage people to make?
Sure. I think people say one thing and do another, and they might monitor their eating at home, but when they go out, they tend to be celebrating, and you're not going to go and get the eggless souffle or whatever. You know what I mean? People just want to treat themselves when they eat out, unless it's, well, even with a business lunch or, you know, depending upon the occasion. People feel like they've earned that right. And by the way, you know, those little heart-healthy symbols on menus and everything don't work very well. They sort of kill a dish. I've heard more chefs talk about that. You know, when they try and do these things, they result in fewer sales. If you don't tell people about them, though, their heart healthfulness or their general healthfulness, they're more apt to buy it.
So it's the finger scold in the back of the head. People kind of see that they hear the finger scold with the little heart healthy thing, even if it isn't really there. What about we see more about like vegetarian people having an interest in vegan, vegetarian, and gluten free dining? Are you seeing that appearing on menus, or is it the same thing? It's a buzzkill.
Well, it can be a buzzkill, but, you know, certain things I see more. Even chain restaurants are doing gluten-free menus right now. And one of the more interesting chain restaurants is Seasons 52. It opened two branches this year in Washington, but they've got dozens of restaurants around the country. It's all about celebrating food and the seasons, but no dish is more than greater than 450 calories or something like that. They don't have butter in the restaurant. They don't have fryers in the restaurant. But they have very good flatbreads with nice toppings. And this is another trend, too, are mini desserts. So you get little votives of maybe three desserts, a miniature cheesecake and a pudding or custard or something else. And somehow two or three bites of two or three really good things is meant to satisfy us. And I think it does.
That's it. I was going to say, does it really?
It does, but you might want three more of those little butters, too.
That's right. What's the best thing you ate all year? I know you try to be fair, but what's the best thing you ate all year? Putting you on the spot.
Oh, the best thing.
Yeah,
that
best
is,
thing.
That is really hard. I've eaten so many good things. You know what? I will say this. A hamburger is a real luxury. I love the hamburgers at Palena. Former White House chef Frank Ruta does one of the best in town. I think it's simple and elegant and basic. He makes his own pickles with it. He makes his own brioche bun.
All right.
And it's less than $10.
Okay. I'm hungry now. Tom Seitzema is a food critic for The Washington Post. His annual spring dining guide was featured in this week's Washington Post magazine. He was nice enough to stop by our D.C. studios and didn't bring us any snacks. Tom, thank you.
Left my carry out at home.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, chess champion Hikaru Nakamura scored his third U.S. chess title this weekend. In a few minutes, we'll hear the songs that he listens to get pumped up and to relax for a big match. But first, we want to talk about justice. Actually, we want to talk about what happens when the justice system fails. A new archive compiled by the University of Michigan Law School and the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University School of Law found that more than 2,000 people convicted of serious crimes have been exonerated in the last 23 years. Now, recently we told you about the notorious case of the Central Park Five. That's the story about five young men who served long sentences for raping and nearly killing a young woman in New York. Years later, evidence emerged that exonerated all of them. Now, there's another story in Washington, D.C. with echoes of that case, and this is probably a good place to mention that the details are very disturbing and might not be appropriate for all listeners. Catherine Fuller was beaten and raped in a particularly vicious way in a Washington, D.C. alley back in 1984. Police blamed a local street gang for Fuller's death. As a result, 17 people were arrested, 2 pleaded guilty, and 6 others were eventually convicted of first-degree murder in 1985. Now that case is getting another look. Defense attorneys gave closing arguments last week in a hearing to determine whether the men convicted of Fuller's murder will get a new trial or even be exonerated. Some observers had concerns about the Fuller case from the start. In 1985, Patrice Gaines was a young reporter covering the story for the Washington Post, and after visiting the neighborhood where the murder took place and interviewing residents, her information conflicted with the official version of events. But she says now she did not have the skill or experience to know what to do with those doubts. Years later, in the 1990s, Gaines began reexamining the case herself and later began speaking out in behalf of the 6 men still behind bars. Patrice Gaines is here with us now to talk about the Catherine Fuller case and her experience covering it. Gaines is a veteran journalist. She's also author of Laughing in the Dark, From Colored Girl to Woman of Color, A Journey from Prison to Power. Patrice Gaines, welcome to the program. Thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, hello. It's my pleasure to be here.
Now, Patrice, I do want to mention here that you and I are former colleagues. I do think that's worth, you know, pointing out. And right. I do remember that, and you never struck me as a particularly shy person. You seem like a very tough reporter. And so I think for a lot of people, they might wonder, people who know you, people who know your work, and also know the reputation of the Post for aggressive reporting. Can you talk a little bit about when you started to have doubts about the official version and why you weren't able to act upon them?
Sure. One of the things is that I wrote features. I didn't do tough investigative pieces, so I really had not honed those skills. But just as a human being and a person who had once lived or at least had been in that community a lot, so going there, I wasn't frightened. And I went out to investigate or to talk to people about this story that the police had told us that there was a gang that had killed this woman, this mother. And the first thing I found that was curious was that no one knew that there was a gang in the neighborhood. Police had described this group of young people as if they had terrorized the neighborhood and, in fact, told me that they said people were too afraid to speak. But I didn't find that. And where they said the murder occurred was in an alley during the day. It was a very busy time. So there were a lot of things to me that didn't make sense. If there were up to 30 people in this alley, as police said, why is it that no regular person, you know, no grandmother, no person coming home from work or running an errand saw this? The only people who saw it were people that the police said saw it who were all young teenagers.
What was it about that made this case so shocking? Was it because of the particular brutality with which the woman was killed? Was it the time of day, the fact that she was a mother? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, at that time, this was in 1984. It was before crack cocaine really, you know, took over the city and created a lot of violence and open-air drug market. So it was also at a time, though, where in California we were hearing about gangs, you know. So it was the national news, gangs, gangs, gangs. And there were police in Washington who tried to convince some of us reporters that, indeed, there were gangs in Washington. But no one had seen evidence of it. So when this occurred, the fact that they said it was a gang, that there were so many young people that pummeled and, you know, beat this woman, stomped her. And the most horrifying detail was that they said that she was sodomized and that she was sodomized with a pole. Mm. Now, that one horrible detail just captivated everyone's attention. And I know I had people even recently say to me that after that they didn't follow the case at all because they didn't care about anybody who would do this. But I have to tell you what I have found in my research is that quite often these cases that are overturned, there is always one horrible detail that makes the suspects seem like animals.
And so you think that there's perhaps such a desire to see someone arrested or held to account for this behavior that people then, what, kind of are willing to overlook inconsistencies like the ones that you found?
Absolutely. I think that all they think is punish them.
Or just get somebody, make somebody responsible for this.
Well, right, someone.
So you went out there, and it just, your sense of that neighborhood, that sense of the community, the sense of what you were hearing from people who live there just didn't square with the official version. Then what happened?
Well, when I first raised it with an editor, the editor really just gave me this blank look like I was a wall. But I hadn't been a reporter long, and I had covered features. So all the other media, because people were outraged, and the media was covering this, you know, and they were pretty much just quoting whatever police said. And I have to say, this was a time when that's what media did. And so it was me saying, you know, me, this inexperienced reporter, saying that I didn't believe what the police were saying or what all the other media believed to be the truth.
We're talking about the case of Catherine Fuller. She's a 48-year-old mother of five who was brutally murdered in 1984. My guest is Patrice Gaines. She is a veteran journalist who covered the case as a young reporter back in 1985. She always had doubts about it, she tells us. And now attorneys for the people who were convicted in the case have asked for a new trial. So the men are convicted.
Yes.
The young people are convicted. Fast forward 10 years.
Sure.
You get a letter from one of the men serving time in this case. Then what happened?
And what happened was I wrote a book, and one of these young men read about my book in the newspaper and wrote me a letter, basically saying that he was still innocent. And when I read that, all of the old doubts that I had came back. And this time I was a different person than I had been. I was more experienced, more confident. And so I decided that really I was going to write a long feature that looked at everything. But what I found out when I started talking to people again was they told me the same stories that they told me, you know, 10 years prior that filled me with doubt. You know, the story of a 16-year-old special ed student who had a 69 IQ who ended up signing a confession. And based on his confession, police began to make arrests. This young man told me that he had been roughed up by the police and also that he was terrified. He was held for hours without a lawyer or any adult. It just went on and on. And the ones that didn't tell the same stories really are the ones that admitted to me that they lied. They were young people who decided at that time that they were going to be witnesses for the police. But now they told me as older adults that they felt that the police had threatened them and that if they didn't become a witness, it meant that they were a part of the gang.
If the evidence suggests that the people who were convicted of the crime didn't do it, who did? Was there other evidence available that pointed to a more logical suspect or suspects?
There was. And that's what came out in the more recent hearing. These young men originally did not, but for the most part, did not have lawyers with resources. They had court-appointed lawyers. But the other thing, the more amazing to me, is that when I was working on this, one of the things I found was evidence that the defense attorneys never received from the prosecutor's office. One of those was the fact that there were witnesses who saw someone else in the alley that night. They saw a man named James McMillan, who later on went on to kill a young woman who was in Washington on an internship on working for a Congress member. Killed her, sodomized her in an alley within blocks of this location. So the fact that this witness four witnesses actually saw him, that information never reached the defense attorneys. So there was information like that, information that Ms. Fuller's wedding ring was purchased on 8th Street by two young people who bought it for $5, which immediately to me said there's somebody with a drug problem. People just don't sell diamond rings for $5. And that alley was known to be used by people who used drugs and who also drank alcohol. So there were a lot of new pieces, but the important thing is that these defense attorneys and these young men, their lawyers, never received that information. Therefore, the jury never heard that information.
Well, Patrice, I think one thing that stands out in this case that's different from the Central Park case is that often when we talk about these cases, race is a factor. In
right.
this case, none of that was true. The victim, an African-American, the alleged perpetrators, it's a majority black experience, the chief of police at that time, an African-American. You see what I'm saying? So I think many people, reasonable people, say, well, why wouldn't they want to know who really was guilty?
In this case, I think that no one cared who got arrested for this. Someone had to be arrested. But I think that it also was very easy to convince, whether it's arrest of a police department, to convince a media that young black people acted like animals. They could not convince the community in which this happened because they knew that that wasn't true. But this community didn't feel powerful enough that it could speak out and say this. So I think, you know, there are times when it doesn't seem as clear cut, but I think it is the same type of racism that is operating there.
As we are speaking now, what's the status of the case? Is it that a judge will take it under advisement and decide whether the men get a new trial?
The judge can decide. He can decide to exonerate them, have a new trial, or send them back to prison.
What do you think we should learn from all this?
Police officers are human beings. Prosecutors are human beings. Mistakes are made. But we have to be vigilant. If we want a justice system that works for all of us, then it has to work for all of us. We can't look at people and say they have no value, just lock them up. We have to watch the process. It has to work correctly for them. We just don't look at the kind of representation that poor people receive in a courtroom, and we need to do that.
What about you, if you don't mind my asking? What effect do you think this has had on you over the years? Do you feel guilty? Do you feel that you bear some responsibility here for the fact that there was not a more skeptical eye placed on the narrative around this case? I mean, what about you?
Well, I tell you, I could talk an hour about that. It's been life-changing for me because, like many people in the public, I realized there were things I was naive about. And I've seen the ugliness that one human being can have toward others. I've seen that. And to really be quite sure that, you know, a young 16-year-old can be roughed up and sign a confession when he can't read it. I mean, that just hits me, you know, deeply. But also, I watched the media grow. We are in the business of questioning, and therefore we have to question and find the truth regardless. And so I was deeply impacted by the fact that we didn't do that, that we didn't value the words of people on the same level. But yet I don't have any guilt today because I had to work through that. What I do feel is that for once in my life, I did the very best I could. I absolutely know I did the very best I could.
Patrice Gaines is a veteran journalist. She's the author of the memoir, Laughing in the Dark, From Colored Girl to Woman of Color, A Journey from Prison to Power. And she was kind enough to join us from member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Patrice Gaines, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now it's time for the occasional feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we speak with some of our guests about the music they love. Today we get the personal playlist of America's top-ranked chess player, Hikaru Nakamura. Over the weekend, Nakamura won the U.S. Chess Championship title in St. Louis, Missouri. It's his third such win. We understand that he's now 2.5 points away from beating Bobby Fischer's all-time record for total points in major competition. Here's what's playing in Hikaru Nakamura's ear.
Pumped Up Kicks by Foster the People. I really like the song, just the vibe, the rhythm to it, and it really gets me pumped up before my next chess match. The next song that I'm listening to is Somebody That I Used to Know by Gotye. I really like this song because it reminds me of the past, my own past, and trying to move forward and focus on the future, on what's going to happen going forward. I'm also listening to Boulevard of Broken Dreams by Green Day. My shadow's only one that walks beside me. My shallow heart's the only thing that's beating. Sometimes I wish. This has long been a favorite of my song because growing up playing chess, I've always felt like I'm on my own trying to do it my own way. And I feel like the lyrics to the song, it just sort of... It reminds me of my whole story growing up and trying to do it on my own, being the best as much as I can. I'm walking down the line that divides me somewhere in my mind, on the borderline of the edge and where I walk along.
That was U.S. Chess Champion for 2012, Hikaru Nakamura, telling us what's playing in his ear. And if you missed my conversation with him that took place just before the competition began, please go to npr.org and click on the Programs tab for Tell Me More so you can be ready to cheer him on when Nakamura will be representing the U.S. in the 2012 Olympiad in Istanbul, Turkey. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.